All right, I think we'll go ahead and get started. And again, welcome all. It's Mitchell Warren from AVAC, and delighted to welcome everyone to this webinar, which is the second in a mini-series that is part of a year-long series on putting prevention on the line, which, as hopefully many of you know, putting prevention on the line was very much part of AVAC's report that came out just a few weeks ago, and we hope to highlight a number of issues related to prevention research and rollout over the course of the next many months following on from that report. At the same time, this week, this is the second of three webinars crammed into a week to really provide opportunity to hear in slightly more detail as well as engage in discussions about some of the critical issues raised at the recent conference on retroviruses and opportunistic infections that took place a couple of weeks ago in Seattle. Some of you may know on Monday there was a call related to women and HIV prevention, in part related to International Women's Day, but also to really look at what we learned in both the FACS microbicide trial and the Partners Demonstration Project. And if anyone is interested and wasn't able to join the recording, and the slides from that call are available on the AVAC website, and we'll be giving you those details later. And the slides and recording from this call will also be there. In addition, tomorrow, Thursday, at noon Eastern, and I'll let you all do the math on what your time is, so 2 hours later than this call, tomorrow is a call looking specifically at oral pre-exposure prophylaxis and a lot of exciting results that were presented at CROI and a lot of conversations about what does it all mean for prevention going forward. But today, in between those two calls, looking at various biomedical interventions, really delighted to welcome you all, and particularly Rafael Sader, to a webinar focused on following the money, as we called it, and really looking at what we know and don't know about cash transfers in both prevention and treatment, and really delighted to do this call in partnership with the HIV Prevention Justice Alliance, a partner of ours on a number of issues. As many of you may know, in the announcement, we'd hope to have two presentations, both Wafa as well as David Wilson from the World Bank. Unfortunately, something came up, and David is not now able to join us. But in the announcement you will have seen, you can get the CROI webcast of David's presentation, which was an overview of a whole range of activities related to cash transfers and financial incentives. And I really encourage people to see that. And we hope to schedule a time when we can follow up and have David do one as well. I personally am so, so happy to have Rafael Sader here, who wears so many hats in this field. It is hard to really do anything briefly in introducing her. But many of you will know that she has for a number of years led in establishing and now directing the ICAP program based at Columbia, which has really been at the forefront of prevention and treatment programs throughout Africa and Asia, based, as I say, at Columbia University, where she's a professor. She is also one of the two principal investigators of the HIV Prevention Trials Network, the NIAID-funded network that leads on a whole range of HIV prevention activities. And delighted that she's here both with ICAP and the HP team, but particularly in her role as the principal investigator on HPTN-065, and perhaps a trial by name that is one of the most clever, TLC+, which I will let her describe, and we'll let her describe the results that she presented at CROI. Just to give you quick logistics, we are in a global mute so that the line is clear for the recording. Dr. Sader will present. We'll then take questions and open it up, and you can ask questions in real time as we go, and then we can take them after she's done presenting through the chat feature for those of you who are on the web interface. If you are not on the web interface and simply dialing in and listening, you'll be able to unmute yourself later in the call, and I'll give instructions. At any point, you can email avac@avac.org, where we will be collecting those questions and be able to feed those to Wafa as we go later on. But with that, I will turn it over to you, Wafa.
Great, and thank you very much, Mitchell, and thanks to AVAC for the opportunity to present some of the findings from HPTN-065. And thank you all friends and colleagues who are on the call this morning, afternoon, evening. So my goal today is to really focus most of my presentation on the abstract presentation that I gave at CROI, but hopefully can add a little bit more information since I only had a very limited time at CROI, and as well as to take some questions from all of you, which I look forward to. So let's get started with the first slide, and I'm thrilled to be presenting this on behalf of the co-chair of the study, Dr. Bernard Branson, as well as many members of the HPTN 065 TLC Plus study team. So as you all know, the use of antiretroviral therapy has been shown efficacious for the prevention of HIV transmission, and this was confirmed in HPTN 052 in the randomized clinical trial in HIV serodiscordant heterosexual couples. There have also been a lot of other evidence that supports this statement based on observational studies as well as based on modeling research. HPTN 065, this study was designed to determine the feasibility of test-linked treat strategy for the prevention of HIV transmission in the United States. HPTN 065 had several study components. It has a component that focused on expanding HIV testing, which used two approaches, social mobilization and universal offer of HIV testing in hospitals and intervention communities, and I'll tell you about these intervention communities in a minute. A second component, looking at linkage to care. A third component, looking at viral suppression. A component that's aimed at prevention for positives, and it also included provider and patient surveys. You can see that the purpose was to really address or try to intervene at almost every element of the HIV care cascade. Today, I'll be presenting on the findings from these two components, the linkage to care component as well as the viral suppression components, and these are the two components that utilize financial incentives to try to enhance linkage to care and viral suppression. At CROI, there was also a poster that described findings from the expanded HIV testing component, and also, as well, there was a poster that described findings from the follow-up provider survey. So what were the objectives of the two components of HPTN 065? The objective was to determine the feasibility as well as the effectiveness of financial incentives on linkage to care of HIV-positive individuals from an HIV test site to an HIV care site within 3 months, and to determine also feasibility and effectiveness of financial incentives on viral suppression defined as less than 400 copies per ml in patients in HIV care. Let's move on to the methods. So where was the study conducted? The study was conducted in two intervention communities, in the Bronx, New York, and in Washington, D.C. And we selected those communities because in the United States, these two communities are two communities that certainly are severely impacted, or most severely impacted by the HIV epidemic. We had 38 sites, HIV tests, and care sites from the Bronx that participate, and a similar number, 38 sites from the Washington, D.C. Community that participated in the site. They included HIV test site as well as HIV care site. This was a site randomized study. So sites were randomized into the two interventions. So for HIV test sites from both the Bronx and Washington, D.C. were randomized to financial incentives versus standard of care, and this was balanced by the baseline number of HIV-positive individuals as well as linkage to care at 3 months at that site based on data prior to the initiation of the study, baseline data. HIV care sites from both communities were randomized to financial incentives or standard of care, and again, this was balanced by the number of HIV patients at that care site, as well as viral suppression levels at that site at baseline. So I'll walk you quickly through the financial incentives and how this was done. So at the HIV test sites, they were assigned to financial incentives. Any individual that was found to be HIV positive received a linkage to care coupon. The individual then could take that coupon, and it could be redeemed at HIV care sites that were participating in the study within 3 months. The individual would receive a $25 gift card for getting follow-up lab tests done, and an additional $100 gift card at completion of provider encounter with the development of a care plan with their provider. At the HIV care sites for the viral suppression component, the sites that were assigned to financial incentives, patients who were engaged in care and who had viral suppression, that is defined at less than 400 copies per ml, they received a $70 gift card. And a maximum of one gift card could be given every 3 months if they fulfilled this criteria. Now, the amount of the financial incentive for both the linkage to care as well as viral suppression was determined based on a broad consultation that we did prior to initiation of the study. We had consultation with the study community advisory group, as well as diversity of providers both in both of the communities where the study would be done, and many other stakeholders as well. Now, one very important feature of the study and a unique feature of the study is that the outcome of linkage to care and the outcome of viral suppression was determined utilizing data from the HIV surveillance system in the U.S. And I'll walk you very quickly to give you the elements of the surveillance system and how we utilize it for determining the outcomes, measuring the outcomes for our study. So HIV test sites will submit any HIV positive, confirmed positive test to the health department and the HIV surveillance system within their community. HIV care sites, all of their viral load as well as the CD4 count results are similarly transmitted as well to the HIV surveillance system at the relevant health department. It's important to indicate that the viral loads that are received in the surveillance system and the information on these patients here do not include whether the patient is receiving or not receiving antiretroviral therapy. So all viral loads, all CD4s, are submitted as well as all HIV positive confirmed tests. Now what happened next is that the data were then aggregated by site. Remember, this is a site randomized study. They were aggregated by site, and these data were then developed into the HPTN 065 database, which was analyzed at the HPTN Statistical Center. Now what are the main outcomes of this study, as measured, again, through the HIV surveillance system? Firstly, linkage to care. This was determined by ascertaining CD4 viral load within 3 months of HIV-positive test through the surveillance system again. For viral suppression overall, we looked at viral load less than 400 copies in patients in care, and we defined in care patients would have at least two CD4 or viral loads in the surveillance system in the last 15 months. We also looked at viral suppression at the peak of the intervention. By this, we mean 18 months from the start of the intervention itself. This would give time for more people at the site to be able to be eligible for the gift cards and achieve viral suppression. And then we looked at four subgroups that were pre-specified for the viral suppression analysis. This includes by community, the Bronx versus Washington, D.C., based on viral suppression at the site, the size of the site, and the type of site. We also had another outcome called continuity of care, and this was measured as CD4 or viral load in the surveillance system in at least 4 of the last 5 quarters for an individual patient. The statistical methods in brief are shown on this slide. For the linkage to care, all cases from October 2011 to December 2012 were included. These are all HIV-positive individuals from those sites. And the logistic regression, weighed by the number of HIV-positive persons at the site and adjusted for baseline linkage to care, was done and accounting for correlation within a site. For the viral suppression and continuity in care outcome, all visits between January 2012 and March 2013 were included in this analysis, and linear regression for proportion virally suppressed at the site were weighed by the number of patients at the site and adjusted again for based on viral suppression, accounting for repeated site measurements over time. And viral suppression at peak of the intervention, again 18 months at the start, after the start of intervention was done for the quarter of October to December of 2012. Now let's move on to the results. Firstly, for the linkage to care intervention. There were 1,109 HIV-positive diagnoses that were identified during the period of the intervention, 357 in the Bronx and 752 in Washington, D.C. 72% were men, 48% were men who have sex with men, 60% were black, 27% Hispanic, and interestingly, 21% were less than 25 years of age. You'll notice, of course, there are differences in the demographics between the two communities. We dispensed coupons. We dispensed 1,061 coupons, and of the coupons that were dispensed, 79% of them were redeemed at an HIV care site, and 79% of the coupons actually were redeemed for both the $25 and the $100 gift certificates at care sites. Now, what about the effect of financial incentives on linkage to care? I'll walk you through this figure. On the left side of the figure are the standard of care sites. On the right side are the financial incentive sites. On the y-axis are the proportion of patients who are linked to care. The blue line, you can see the blue lines here, these indicate the baseline linkage to care. The bar indicates the mean change for each site, and green means an increase, and red means a decrease in linkage to care. And the width of the bar indicates the number of patients testing positive at the site. Just to let you know that the mean HIV positives per HIV test was 33 and the geometric mean was 16 per site. We observed that over time during the conduct of the study, there was an increase in linkage to care at all of the sites, both the standard of care and the financial incentive site. When we examined and compared financial incentives versus the standard of care sites, we did not see a significant effect of financial incentives on increasing the odds of linkage to care. You can see here the odds ratio as well as the p-value and the confidence interval. Now, what about the viral suppression intervention? We had a total of 19,185 patients in care in the two communities, 10,455 in the Bronx and 8,720 in Washington, D.C. These were at 17 hospitals and 20 community sites. It's important to highlight that this study was truly a community-focused study, and the majority of people in care from those communities actually were included as part of the analysis for this study. There were 9,641 patients who were eligible for gift cards. There were, in terms of qualifying for gift cards, there were 49,650 visits that qualified for gift card based on the viral suppression definition that I mentioned before, and a total of almost 40,000 gift cards were dispensed. What about the effect of financial incentives on the proportion of viral suppression by site? Again, this is a similar figure. On the left, standard of care. On the right are the financial incentive sites. Here, on the other hand, on the y-axis is the proportion of patients virally suppressed. The blue line is the baseline viral suppression at that site, and the bar indicates the mean change in viral suppression for each site. Again, green means an increase, red means a decrease, and the width of the bar indicates the relative number of patients in care at that site. There was a mean of 438 patients per site and a geometric mean of 243 patients per site. Similar to linkage to care, we also observed over time during the conduct of the study an increase in proportion of patients virally suppressed across the board in both the standard of care and the financial incentive sites. When we looked at the effect of financial incentives on viral suppression across the board, we saw there was an increase by 3.9%, which is not statistically a significant effect. And you can see here the confidence intervals with cross 1 and the p-value non-significant finding. Now, we then looked at the pre-specified subgroups that I described to you before. And on this slide, we looked at the effect by community, Washington, D.C. versus the Bronx, New York. And again, when you look at the p-values and the confidence intervals, we did not see a significant effect by looking at each community and the effect of financial incentives on viral suppression. However, when we examined the effect of financial incentives of viral suppression, we noted that at sites that had lower viral suppression at baseline, meaning at the sites that had less than 65% of the patients virally suppressed, there was a significant effect of financial incentives on viral suppression, an increase by 10.4%, which was statistically significant. We also observed as well that when we looked at the effect of financial incentives by the site type, whether it's a hospital type of site or a community site, we noticed that by examining hospital sites, that financial incentives did have also a significant effect on increase in proportion virally suppressed when compared to standard of care sites. You can see here an increase by 5.2%, statistically significant effect. When we looked at by size of site, meaning this is dichotomized by the median number of patients at the site, you see that we saw a trend towards an effect of financial incentives on increasing the proportion of patients virally suppressed at sites that had fewer numbers of patients. Let's move on then to another outcome, which is at the effect of financial incentives on viral suppression at the peak of the intervention. As I mentioned, this was the fourth quarter of 2012, 18 months after the initiation of the study. Here again, on the left are the standard of care sites, on the right, the financial incentive sites. And similarly, the blue line is the baseline proportion viral suppression. And as I mentioned again, green, the mean increase, and red, decrease, and the width of the bar are the numbers of patients at the site. And we saw, when we looked at this outcome, that there was a significant effect of financial incentives of viral suppression at the peak of the intervention, an increase by 5.4%, which was statistically significant effect, when compared again to standard of care sites. Now, when we looked at some of the same pre-specified subgroups, focusing now on the effect at the peak of the intervention, we did see, this is the overall effect that I mentioned to you just in the prior slide, we looked at by community there was a trend towards an effect in Washington, D.C. at the peak of the intervention. There was also similarly a significant effect of financial incentives on viral suppression at the peak of the intervention at sites with lower baseline viral suppression, and at smaller sites with fewer numbers of patients. Now, what about change in proportion in continuity care? And here you see the same figures, except that on the y-axis is the proportion of patients having continuity of care. And again, the baseline, the in blue, is the baseline continuity in care based on the definition I mentioned before. And again, similarly, green bar means an increase, red bar means a decrease, and the width is the numbers of patients at that site. And when we looked at this outcome of continuity care by site, we did see a significant effect of financial incentives on the proportion of patients who are in continuity care. The increase was by 8.1%, which was statistically significant when comparing those sites with financial incentives versus standard of care. So what are the study's strengths and limitations? This was a unique study that has some interesting strengths. Firstly, it's a community-based study that included a large number of HIV testing care sites, almost 80 that participated in the study. And also importantly, included most HIV-positive patients in care in the two communities. So it really was looking at an effect at a very, very, attempted to look at an effect at a very, very broad level. Also, it's distinguished by the diversity of sites. As you saw, we had hospitals, community-based clinics, private, public facilities, as well as small and large size. Another unique aspect of the study, which is a strength but also maybe a weakness, is the use of the HIV surveillance system to measure study outcomes. This is important because in the United States, where we have a robust HIV surveillance system, and when we're hopefully going to be trying to demonstrate the effect of our interventions at a community level or at a level of a large population, it's going to be impossible to enroll every single patient in the study, and therefore having the ability to look at outcomes at a population level through something like the HIV surveillance system is really quite unique and important. And lastly, also, we demonstrated that it was feasible to establish a system for the distribution accounting of financial incentives at scale. Now, what are the limitations of this study? I think number one important limitation, as I mentioned to you, is that the surveillance system does not distinguish patients by ART status. So it means when we're looking at an effect of financial incentives of viral suppression, we're looking at a site level. That includes individuals who are on ART and individuals who are not on ART at that site. We cannot distinguish ART status. In addition, reporting of lab data, CD4 and viral loads was done by place of residence in some settings rather than by site of care, and it's particularly in DC, and it's really important for us to link the viral load and the CD4 to the site because this was a site randomized study. And there was some incomplete reporting by some sites. We had limited power for linkage to care component. The number of people identified, the mean number of people identified as HIV positive at the HIV test sites that we had during the conduct of the study was much lower than what would have been anticipated based on our assumptions, and those assumptions were based on the data we had at the baseline at the time when we started the study for those sites. And lastly, there was a change in the ART treatment guidelines during the course of the study. So as you're aware, early in 2012, the guidelines changed to offering HIV treatment to all patients who are HIV positive. So that happened midstream in the study. So here's a summary of the findings. HPTN-065 demonstrated the feasibility of use of financial incentives for linkage to care and viral suppression and for measuring outcomes via the HIV surveillance system. Overall, we noted over time that both linkage to care and viral suppression increased over time in both arms of the study. The use of financial incentives did not increase linkage to care. This is possibly due to limited power we have to detect such an effect. Financial incentives did not increase viral suppression overall. However, they significantly increased viral suppression in certain settings. That is, we noted a significant effect at sites with lower baseline viral suppression, at sites with fewer patients and hospital-based HIV care sites. At the peak of the intervention, we did note a significant effect of that financial incentives had a significant effect on increasing viral suppression. And lastly, financial incentives significantly increased engagement in care as evidenced by regular clinic attendance. So in conclusion, HPTN-065 demonstrated that financial incentives have a potential role in achieving viral suppression. Further research is warranted of financial incentives in specific populations and in certain settings, which is what we saw. We saw an effect in the subgroups, but not an overall effect of financial incentives and viral suppression. In addition, studies with sufficient power are needed to assess the effectiveness of financial incentives for linkage to care. We clearly did not have power to answer that question based on the findings from our study. And lastly, also in the HPTN, we're planning to do some modeling to try to estimate the impact of financial incentives for viral suppression at a population level based on the effect sizes that we saw in the subset of patients based on the findings from our HPTN-065 findings. So I just want to acknowledge this was a huge study that involved a lot of people, a lot of sites, a lot of communities, a lot of stakeholders. Firstly, acknowledge the Departments of Health from New York City, Washington, D.C., as well as from non-intervention communities, Chicago, Houston, Miami, and Philadelphia. The investigators at all the participating HIV testing care sites, patients from the participating communities and, of course, the HPT and O65 Community Advisory Group. And the study is supported by National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, National Institute of Mental Health, as well as by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Thank you.
Great. Well, Wafa, thank you so, so much. And I'm so glad we had more time than your rapid 10 minutes at the retrovirus meeting to get more of the detail and the nuance. So thank you so very much. I do want to remind people there are a number of ways to ask questions. We already have several that have come in via email. Others, please feel free to email at avac@avac.org. You can also enter them into the chat function in ReadyTalk. And in just a moment, I'll offer people a chance to ask them directly by unmuting your line by pressing *7. We would ask that you mute your line again after the question and the answer with *6. So *7 in just a moment. But a question actually just came in the chat feature that you probably have seen often. Several emails kind of gravitated around this same question about could you comment on the amount of the incentive and it, you know, how this did or didn't differ from what was suggested by stakeholders, and if after now seeing the results and if there's been any engagement, someone asked, with the participants in the trial, would the amount have made a significant difference, and if so, how much? So both in terms of how it was set and then the implications potentially for the future.
Sure. I mean, as of course, as you know, before we started the study, in general, I think the use of financial incentives is a controversial topic, and it was so we needed to do a lot of work before we started the study to make sure that we would have the buy-in as well as from the stakeholders and the many stakeholders, as well as, of course, that we're doing something that is feasible and that if it's found to be effective would be doable, would be may be embraced by public health authorities and so on. So there were many, many consultations from meeting with community groups, meeting with patient groups, discussions with provider groups as well. And there's no perfect answer to the amount of the incentive, but this was the consensus that was arrived at based on these many, many consultations. There are other studies that have used, for example, different levels of incentives and, you know, and compare different levels. We obviously, this was such a large-scale study, and we didn't want to complicate it by having different amounts and so on and so forth. So there is no perfect answer to the amount of financial incentive. It varies substantially by setting, by country, by community, and also I think should be really shaped by conversations and consultations within those communities. So that is that's kind of in sum my observation. I think the other thing that we did after the completion of the study is we also conducted a qualitative study. And some of the findings from the qualitative study were presented at the R4P meeting in Cape Town. And the posters are available on the R4P website. And that study, that was a qualitative study that was done at the end, going to the sites, asking the staff at the sites and the participants at the sites how they felt about the financial incentives and so on. And that was also the feedback was quite positive from the sites and the participants. So that's kind of how we prepared and how we did it. There were many people who raised a lot of, you know, doomsday scenarios about what would happen with financial incentives, whether patients would flock from a site that was not giving financial incentives to sites that were giving financial incentives. There'd be distortion of the whole healthcare kind of system and structures, and we did not see that. That did not happen. There was no widespread or theft or, you know, it was, in a way, I think over time there was ability by the site and by the patients of the financial incentive approach.
Great, thanks. You know, Wafa, a follow-on question came in via email about it, not so much the amount itself, but questions about sustainability. So what happens afterwards, and perhaps if there had been an even bigger effect size seen across the board, what kind of conversations were happening, particularly with the local health departments, in terms of you know, how does one sustain a cash transfer financial incentive program after it officially ends in a research setting? Were there conversations with the departments, and if they'd seen an effect, were they willing to invest, do you know?
Well, I think that as you can imagine, the Department of Health were intimate part of the study, actually, because we utilized the HIV surveillance system, which means the Department of Health in both communities. So they were very involved in the design and conduct of the study and the analysis of the findings from the study from day one. I think that, in essence, I think what there was a sense that this kind of experiment needed to be done to see what the findings were, and that the findings of the study could inform a conversation, you know, as to whether this would be doable, feasible to be done, et cetera, in the different communities. Now, there has been a study that was done. It was modeling and trying to see what might be a cost-effective intervention for prevention. And there was one paper that was published several years ago that indicated that if you had an intervention that did work, had an effect and cost about, this is in the U.S., and cost about kind of $5,000 per person per year, that would be considered a cost-effective intervention. So using that kind of broad rubric, we felt that if found to be effective, this would fit within those types of, within the range in terms of cost-effectiveness.
Great. No, thank you so much. I'm going to open the lines in just a second or ask people to unmute if they have questions, but there was a great question that came in. And just for clarification, I don't know if you see this, but in terms of clarifying, in terms of the linkage to care, you presented that the number of HIV-positive cases in surveillance was just over 1,100 and for gift cards about 1,061. Question is, how are these numbers so close if the sites were randomized? Shouldn't half of the cases not received a coupon? And also a question about the time periods, one being 15 months, one being 24 months.
Yes, 24 months and 15, I'm sorry, which one?
So there was a question about the time periods being different. One was 15 months and one was 24
months. Because some of the components of the study started after other components.
Okay.
That's one. And I think the numbers of, the coupons were dispensed because, yes, because the... these were the diagnosed. Remember, we're basing our findings based on the positives in the surveillance system, right? So there's two things that are happening. The people are identified positive at a site, for example, and then they, but we would not be able to count them unless they appeared in the surveillance system as a positive patient, right? So, and there also are patients who were known to be positive before. We're trying to get at the numbers who are newly positive who would appear in the surveillance system. So we may have given more coupons because you cannot tell at a site whether somebody is newly diagnosed or not. They may have been diagnosed before, they may have been diagnosed at another site and so on. So that's why there's a difference in the numbers.
Great. No, that's super helpful. Let me know other emails, other questions have come to the email and chat, but let me just pause now. Anyone, *7 to unmute your line, please do introduce yourself, but would love to have any questions. *7 again. So one question did come in. Let me ask that while people are gathering their questions. And, you know, Wafa, this was obviously very much in a treatment setting. There's been a lot of conversation about cash transfers in prevention settings. Do you have a sense coming out of this what kind of the research agenda, whether it's for the HPTN as an entity or just your own thinking as an investigator, what might be some of the variations in a prevention setting compared to focusing on people actually trying to link them into care and viral suppression, which certainly has the prevention benefit? But do you have a sense of what are the major next steps for the prevention, primary prevention and financial incentive questions?
Yes. As you know, there's a lot of interest in primary prevention, use of financial incentives, and certainly David Wilson, who was unable to participate but gave an excellent talk at CROI, presented some of the data that are available of studies that have been largely sponsored by the World Bank that looked at the effect of financial incentives on HIV acquisition, particularly those several of the studies that were done in sub-Saharan Africa. The latest one was done in Lesotho. The HPTN is conducting an ongoing study called HPTN-065. That is being conducted in South Africa, and that study is utilizing financial incentives contingent on attendance, school attendance by young girls in South Africa, and it's an individual randomized study, and the study is going to be completed actually soon, and the primary outcome of the study is to look at also HIV acquisition by these young girls and to see if using financial incentives contingent on them continuing to attend school, whether that is protective from acquiring HIV infection. So there are diversity of efforts that are trying to look at use of financial incentives in that context, particularly for high-risk individuals like young women in Southern Africa, for example. At the same time, there also are attempts to use financial incentives to encourage men to get, male circumcision. So this is a very robust area of research at this point in time. At ICAP, we are doing two studies, actually, but they're much more similar to O65 that are looking at their implementation science types of studies. One is being conducted in Swaziland, the other one in Mozambique, looking at, again, in the effect of financial incentives, again, in terms of for the HIV care cascade, linkage and retention. Not viral suppression because they don't have available viral suppression, so we're looking at retention as a surrogate.
Great. That's super. Thank you. Again, star 7, if people have questions. There was a quick one that came in on the chat feature. In terms of the coupons that were provided, someone asked, were they general that someone could use anywhere, or were they specific so people were forced to use it in a particular place, and wondering, I guess, if not just the amount matters, but how the form in which the amount comes, if that would make any difference.
That's a very important question. And we decided that we explored a variety of different ways of doing this at the beginning of the study, and we ended up utilizing essentially bank cards, like I would call it maybe like a debit card, essentially. So it was a gift card. It could be used anywhere.
Okay.
So it was very, very flexible. As it was dispensed to the patient, they fulfilled all the criteria, then they could activate it themselves, or sometimes the healthcare worker would activate it for them, and then they could utilize it anywhere they wanted to.
Great. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is Anna Hurd from 3IE.
Hi, Anna. Welcome.
Thanks. I was wondering if they had done any follow-up research to look at, once the program ends, what happens to viral suppression when the financial incentives are no longer there?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We're actually aiming to do that. So we're aiming to, again, query the surveillance system about a year after we've done, after the intervention ended, to actually see what happens thereafter. So and that's another advantage of use of the surveillance system, is you can query the surveillance system after your intervention and see what the effect, whether there's what the effect is thereafter. So that's also planned as well.
Great. Two additional questions have come in, both looking at to see if you have, if you'd like to speculate on two different results that you presented. What you might think would explain the fact that the sites with the lower baseline suppression had the positive effect of the intervention, and also why might the financial incentives not had as big a result in the linkage to care. Any hypotheses that you've all thought of as you've analyzed the data?
Well, I think for the linkage to care, we really cannot say that it worked or did not work, because we just did not have enough power to say anything about that question. We estimated that we needed a much larger number of HIV positive persons per site to be able to empower the study accordingly, and we had many fewer, during the study. So it's impossible to actually say whether it worked or it did not work. We just did not have any power. And that's why, in my conclusion, I think this question remains open. In terms of sites that have low viral suppression to start with, I think this is something that people have raised before, is whether the, you know, we give individuals that, at the site that were assigned to financial incentives, whether somebody had been financially, was suppressed for years and years and years, and they came to the site, and they continued to come to the site, and they were still virus suppressed, they did get a gift card, right? And so it kind of may have maintained those who are virally suppressed versus whether what the effect is in terms of when you have the effect might be when you have people who are not actually virally suppressed, so that you actually can have an effect on getting them to viral suppression. And that's why we thought that maybe use of financial incentive site that had lower viral suppression motivated those individuals that were not suppressed, or motivated the providers at those sites to talk more about adherence and viral suppression with their patients, et cetera, et cetera. So that may be why we saw more an effect at those sites than the sites that already were doing well at baseline.
Great. Thanks for that. Other questions on the line? Star 7 again to unmute yourself. Actually, one question that did just come in via email, and maybe I'll pause just again. Star 7, I know it sometimes takes time to get off mute. Anna was modeling great positive behavior. I wish I could give financial incentives to get people to stop emailing and start speaking, but that's okay. And a question that came in separately on email, were participants reimbursed for participating in the study, as in many studies, separately from the incentive to actually, as designed in the study itself? So were participants compensated at all?
No, they were not.
Okay. And also a question, how did you advertise it? Given that it's the surveillance system, did you just rely on the existing infrastructure, or was there actually an outward-facing recruitment strategy?
A recruitment of?
Of the participants. So was it just through the surveillance program, or someone asked, was it advertised, using posters and other information for recruitment materials that did or didn't talk about the fact that there'd be this financial incentive?
What was done, the individuals, that the study did not recruit individual patients. This was a site randomized study.
Okay.
Recruit individual patients. What we did is we worked, of course, to get IRB approvals and so on, and then the site participated, and we had information available at the participating sites, whether they be financial incentives or standard of care, that told the people who were getting care of those sites that the site was participating in the study, and so on and so forth. So, and obviously we worked on training the healthcare workers and so on at the site about the study. So the information was available, and then the providers and staff at the sites then informed all of the patients that this was ongoing at their site.
Great. Someone else asked an interesting one. Do you have a sense, and again, it may not be from the data that you presented here in this particular study, but the use of incentives for one-time actions versus repeated behavior modification, and if you have a sense of the literature generally or future research, if one can imagine differences between those two desires that anyone might have.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there's been some of the data that are very interesting about the children effect of financial incentives have been in repeated kinds of behaviors. Like, for example, there have been studies that have looked at smoking cessation, which obviously you have to maintain. There have been studies that looked at use of anticoagulants in patients who need anticoagulation drugs to maintain their levels appropriately. So that's also an ongoing behavior. Clearly, the ones that have been done by the World Bank, for example, that are more related to HIV prevention, obviously they are related to trying to influence an ongoing behavior. So there's been interest in those. There have been also a lot of literature on using financial incentives. For example, there's a rich literature in Mexico, for example, where they've used financial incentives to try to get, you know, women to bring their children for, well, baby visits and vaccination visits. So it's been linked to trying to influence behaviors often on an ongoing basis.
Great. Now, that's really helpful. And you mentioned earlier the issue of potentially cash transfers related to voluntary medical male circumcision. And I know data presented, I believe it was in Melbourne, if I'm not mistaken, last year at the International AIDS Conference, which is getting, you know, very successfully in Kenya, getting men to come in for much more of a one-off procedure as opposed to the ongoing behavior. So an interesting area. One of the questions come in from a couple of different people, and this is both for you, and I'm not sure if anyone, we invited a number of people from UNAIDS in Geneva, so a little bit different again from the study itself, but as I think many people on the line will know, and well, you will certainly know, UNAIDS has been working towards the development of prevention targets as part of a comprehensive plan in addition to the earlier stated 90-90-90 targets. And one of those targets in the draft that came out late last year, and I think we're all waiting for the finalized version of those targets, but one of the targets specifically talked about for young women and adolescent girls to have access to cash transfers and other financial support to empower them and to change their behaviors. And they actually put a target that of a percentage of women that should have access to it. And I just wonder if you had thoughts, given this is a very active area of research, if you had, what your sense is of a target for coverage of something like financial incentives and cash transfers in the context of prevention and treatment, given your work and your knowledge of the space generally?
I think it's hard to, that's a tough question. I think it's hard to even imagine how to come up with a target. I think the issue is that, there are lots of things that need to be determined. I think first is, of course, we're waiting for O6, the results of HPT and O6A to look at this whole issue of school attendance, because that's a very important issue. And we can, if we can tide young women through a very vulnerable period of time in southern Africa, where rates of acquisition of HIV are enormous, and if financial incentives do work, then it might be well worth it to consider that at high coverage rates. So that's a very specific population. I think in terms of other broader kinds of coverage, again, it remains, apart from the studies that were done by the World Bank, and some of them looked at prevalence, for example, versus incidence, so may require replication and so on. It will require really trying to see what can be done in the context of a country, for example. Sometimes they've used this almost like some of the very broad programs that provide for orphans, for example, and that are part of a country's system of dispersal of funds. Those are kind of practical issues that need to be considered, and then how do you target those specific population is difficult. So I think it's an important question, but I think if we do identify specific populations that are at very high risk, where we know something can work to protect them, I think it would really be important to provide high coverage with this intervention for such a group.
That's a great answer. I'm not sure if anyone is on from Geneva. I'll pause. *7 again to unmute. I think it's a terrific answer, Wafa, and I think one that take the chair's prerogative, something that we at AVAC have put in our comments to UNAIDS, that while there's an important area of work around cash transfers and financial incentives, the coverage-based targets may not be the most appropriate broadly for all interventions. 90-90-90 is a really important target. Scaling up circumcision, a critically important target, but not all interventions can benefit from the same kind of coverage target, especially with so many unanswered questions still about its operation. So really, really helpful. Let me pause again at *7 for any last questions from anyone on the line as we draw to a close at the top of the hour. One just came in, which I do think is a really important one. To what extent might we extrapolate results from one study to another? Always a challenging question. But Washington and the Bronx to other cities, and Washington and the Bronx and the United States, urban cities to other countries. You know, always hard to do. It's the question that comes up in every study. But thoughts on that, Wafa?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it varies so substantively from setting to setting, and it's hard to, I think an intervention, clearly how we, for example, one important thing about this, I think that demonstrating the feasibility that you can do this at scale was very important and is hopefully can be replicated elsewhere. Obviously, the availability of gift cards may differ from country to country, and in other countries, for example, I know that in ICAP, in our studies, we're not utilizing gift cards. We're utilizing airtime on cell phones, which are easily transferred and very convenient. So one has to adapt how you deliver the financial incentives based on the circumstances and the context. I think measuring the outcome is also very important and will differ substantially. I mean, we were lucky and to have the surveillance system here in the U.S. Obviously, unfortunately, not many countries have a surveillance system of the depth of the U.S. system where you can look at some of these outcomes, even though with the limitations of the surveillance system is also something to keep in mind. Now, there are other ways of doing it, studying this in other contexts that may require following large cohorts of individuals. It can be done at a district level, for example, and compare an intervention district versus a non-intervention district, or use a step wedge design to have a sequenced rollout of the intervention and measure the outcome. So I do think that one has to take into account the context and to shape not just the amount of the financial incentive, but how it's going to be delivered and to whom and how you're going to measure the outcomes.
Great. No, fantastic. And a great question and a really great answer as well. I want to thank everyone, and especially you, Wafa, for the care in which you've walked us through this, not just around the results of the study itself, but of the larger landscape related to this issue. As you said early on, this has been a complex and sometimes controversial area of work, and this is a really important piece of evidence that you and the whole team at HPTN have put together, and really grateful for that and for everyone being on the line. I do want to remind everybody that this series of Putting Prevention on the Line continues actually tomorrow at noon Eastern, and again in the times of clocks have changed in the U.S. but not yet in Europe, and they don't change in Africa, but at noon tomorrow Eastern, a conversation about the oral PrEP results coming out of CROI, and perhaps most importantly, what are the implications for all of us as advocates, policymakers, funders, researchers, and thinking through the next steps. Jean-Michel Molina from the ANRS, who led the IPRGAY study, and Sheena McCormick from the Medical Research Council in the UK, who led the PROUD study, will both be on, as well as other people working in PrEP to talk about the implications there. So please do feel free to join us. The recording of this call and slides, as well as the recording and slides from Monday's call on women and HIV prevention, and certainly tomorrow's call will all be archived, and they're available on the AVAC.org website. And again, as Wafa said as well, David Wilson did provide a really lovely summary around financial incentives and cash transfers, and we will be sure that link is available from his CROI presentation, available on the website as well. So really encourage you to look at this. I am confident that this will be one of many conversations about this, and we certainly look forward, Wafa, to having you and Audrey Pettifor, the protocol chair of HPTN 068, on when those results come out to expand our thinking about cash transfers and prevention for young women. So enormously grateful to all of you for joining, and Wafa, thank you again for spending time and walking us through all of this, and look forward to hearing much more.
Thank you all very much, and thank you very much, Mitchell. Have a good day, everyone.
Great. Cheers, all.
Bye.